Barbecue Salsa here on this Saturday, October 20th of 2012. And welcome to the 63rd episode of the Last Bastille podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at radioforall.net. I should also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alassize's A Puzzling Predicament, and the outro will be Bose's King's Quest, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons Attribution, specifically CC BY NC SA 3.0 unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bastille blog, which is located over at The Last Bastille. Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E, thelastbastille.wordpress.com. Now, there's a bit of news I want to kind of go over before I get into the topic for this particular episode, and it's really more just three items. The first item is that on the blog, I've changed the category of essential concepts to the establishment, since there has been some pretty noticeable confusion about the the theme of the articles. So I hope that that clears it up. Basically, these are articles examining different aspects of the control system itself, which the dozen or so podcasts also have been describing. Now, there will be more upcoming in the future as I write them. But, you know, at the same time, I want to avoid the trap that earlier researchers have fallen into by becoming too obsessed with the enemy's vast creation. So I figure that some balance is needed, especially because I want my efforts and also those whom I associate with to focus more heavily on think tank-styled brainstorming and field testing of various methods, tactics, etc. So really, I mean, yes, when you're starting out, especially if you're trying to appeal to folks within those portions of the mainline public, you need to tell them at least some aspects of the enemy establishment as much as possible, or at least as much as they're willing to take in, because you don't want to also suffer the other trap of putting them into information overload, which also is another way of running them off, especially if you're trying to recruit them for anything. So, I mean, there's other aspects. I mean, there's the police state and then various sub-areas of that. There's the imperialistic wars of aggression, the welfare state. And then, of course, the one subject that I have, and it's various sub-subjects that I've been avoiding, and I will announce this for the first time publicly here. At some point, I do need to get into eugenics, because that is the deeper level philosophy of the establishment itself, but I figured it's more important to really focus on more of the how about stuff that you're coming across that's more easily understood, like the police state, for example. Besides the fact, I've also noticed that the carnival of distractions within the alternative media tends to have this attitude of taking the various efforts by the establishment that stem from eugenics and sensationalizing it, fear-mongering it, and making people unrealistically paranoid to the degree that they're basically frozen in their seat and therefore don't do anything to actually resist tyrants. And so that's another reason I've been delaying on that. But no, at some point it needs to be gotten into, but it's also important in terms of the method of presentation to be calm and rational about it as much as possible, so people can actually focus on the content of what's being mentioned instead of having to experience the emotional roller coaster of getting so angry. Nobody needs that. That's stupid. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are times when genuine emotions will flare up with certain things, but It doesn't need to be like that all the time! And nobody really needs that, so... That's just something I wanted to bring to your folks' attention. The second item is that there's also the possibility of having the podcast being hosted elsewhere. I've been offered by a few different people since the untimely demise of YHTOM, unfortunately, to host the podcast on their servers, but I've been reluctant to accept any offers as of yet, especially considering my history, both with obviously people can go back in the archives because I've described what's happened before as far as hosting the podcast goes, or at least some of the more recent things. And so considering my history as well as the fact that if I were to accept these offers, that would mean kind of similar to my New Colony Media NCM days over on Blog Talk Radio, it would have to be on a fairly regular schedule. You know, that's antithetical to traditional podcasting, which is basically just do it whenever, which is what I have been doing with Radio for All. And so when you get onto that regular schedule, I mean, it's not that it's bad, it's just that it just requires it to be done, you know, whatever the frequency is. For me, it was, you know, 2 to 3 hours once a week. So it's antithetical to traditional podcasting, and it really crosses over into the realm of internet talk radio, which technically I've done that too, but that's the thing, you know, you don't have the flexibility like you do have with traditional podcasting. So that's something that's not great. But, you know, I might cross over and do that again. I just haven't decided yet. But even when I do, should I choose to hitch up with one of them, I'm still going to continue. What I absolutely have decided is that I'm still going to use radioforall.net as a backup archive, just in case my bad luck decides to catch up with me again and, you know, I either get kicked out, like what happened with New Colony Media, or whomever I'm working with, their website goes down and doesn't get back up, kind of like what happened with You Have Tread on Me. So I'll keep using Radio for All as a backup archive in either case. So don't worry, it's, you know, this type of archive is not going anywhere. So far it's been stable, it's been good, so I'll just keep using it. So even if I do use the other people's stuff, I'll just get a copy and throw it up on here, so don't worry about that. And finally, on to the third item. I kind of mentioned this all to some degree on the first item, but I want to detail more about the type of content I'm starting to get into. I've just started with my studies into military science. So not only the survivalists, but more particularly the various militia units should be interested in some of the upcoming episodes. The guerrilla bands of whatever political persuasion should also be intrigued, since conventional, unconventional, and psychological warfare affects us all and become that much more important whenever the various remedies that are fundamentally based in legal process ultimately fail to achieve their goals. So, you know, it's something that needs to be covered. You know, I've also mentioned before about how other podcasters, you know, they'll yell and whine, scream and bitch about, you know, the 20 millionth awful thing the establishment did this week. They'll complain about the latest unconstitutional federal action that's being imposed on the various 50 state governments, and then claiming it's constitutional when it's not, you know, on and on and on, whatever it all is. And, you know, at some point, I'll say this much. You know, lawful process, various methods that depend on lawful process do have their place, and sometimes they can mitigate, or even totally solve a given problem, whatever it is. But, you know, when lawful process fails, or some methods of lawful process fails, what do you do then? What then? You know, this is a question that's not really been brought up a lot. And some people make noise about, you know, self-defense, and then they'll say stupid shit, and then either nothing good happens, or nothing constructive happens, or worse, somebody gets thrown in jail for saying something foolish or whatever. It's just, you know, that doesn't help anybody. You know, we want to take, you know, 5 steps forward with no steps back. That should be the goal. That should be the, or at least the, that should be the mentality at the very least. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of important, you know, if a certain method, let's say state nullification that Thomas Woods and Michael Bolden and all these other guys have been mentioning, and I'll go into it in detail, I'll go into detail about that particular method on a different episode. But if a method like that or some of the others just doesn't work with something, what then? I mean, what, you know, so what? I mean, it didn't work and now you're screwed. You know, that's not fair to anybody. So we have to have some sort of backup, and really the only thing that has historically worked time and again is resorting to force. And particularly in the tradition, what's also known as the sheepdog tradition, or also known as the Minuteman prerogative. There's these different terms that basically typify to the same thing. But basically the notion of the proper warrior, the notion of the warrior, or warrior class, you know, the guys who are basically defending their nation against hostile aggression and the initiation of force, and somebody has to push back against that, which does require force itself. So I think it's important to at the very least study it, because there's some guys in the Patriot community that just kind of go half-kilter overreacting to certain things that really weren't call-ups. And then on the other hand, you've got a lot of libertarians and even a lot of folks from the anarchist circles who then say, oh, violence is never the answer. It's just, you know, the past. So, you know, you don't, there's got to be a balance between outright pacifism and being a sheepdog. Or, excuse me, the sheepdog is basically the balance between pacifism and overreacting to supposed alarms that really weren't alarms. There's got to be a balance point. The balance point is being a sheepdog. But in order to be a sheepdog, you have to actually understand how force is used physically. And that's where the study of military science comes in. And yeah, a subset of that is guerrilla warfare, and I will have to get into that. In fact, if you look at the literature reviews category on the blog, I think it was called John Ellis's book. It was called From the Barrel of a Gun. You can read my review of his book, but I've already started getting into it, and there's more coming on the way, more book reviews. But as far as the podcast goes, you know, I was going to get into military science, and then also getting more into more specific things. So keep an eye out for those. Now, for this particular episode, so that's the news and updates with the podcast and various things that I'm starting to transition both away from and into. So I'll just let that sit. But for this, I guess this thus far last installment about the establishment, for now, until I've written some more. We're going to get into what is known as fractional reserve lending. This was originally an article that was posted on, actually it was earlier this month, on October 4th. And it is entitled, what else, Fractional Reserve Lending. We live in a world of illusion. Ever since we were set in front of the television to rot in our crap-filled diapers, we have been sold a bill of goods on nearly everything we take for granted, particularly with regard to the very nature of money itself. Having been propagandized to believe that money has value, we come to find that such is not the case with the specific currency we have become mentally dependent on for our entire way of life. Most of our waking hours are spent chasing after it, attempting to accumulate more of it, performing tasks we would otherwise prefer to not do, but instead tolerate because we have to somehow pay the bills. Fractional reserve lending is a banking practice that is nothing more than legalized mass counterfeiting. It is a common law offense, simply due to the fact that it violates the precepts of natural justice by surreptitiously cheating the populace out of their wealth through forgery of sound money, which is given sanction by the government due to lobbying, more accurately, the bribery from the banking cartel. This gaggle of crooks conspired to institute a central bank that would be the hub for the entire cartel when they met on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia in 1910 to write the Federal Reserve Act, which was passed in 1913 thanks to the efforts of one of their own members, Senator Nelson Aldrich. Before explaining precisely how this ingenious mechanism works, the greenbacker explanation, tinged with Austrian economic principles of how the method developed historically, could probably be best demonstrated in the form of a broadly allegorical tale. In ye old times, people would engage in direct barter as a form of mutually beneficial trade so as to increase their own wealth. However, direct barter suffers from both the double coincidence of wants as well as the profound problem of indivisibility. This gave rise to indirect barter, which necessitated some mediums of exchange in order to facilitate commerce. These initial mediums are the original forms of money that not only have an inherent value as a commodity in and of itself, but also as a value measured relative to other real goods and services provided by the free market. Now, what emerged as the most useful forms of money were precious metals, particularly gold and silver, because they function best in terms of being a medium of exchange, a unit of account, a store of value, and also possessing the quality of anonymity. However, trading gold and silver directly became eventually burdensome due to their weight, ease of theft, and additional divisibility problems. What people ended up doing was storing their precious metals in the vaults of the goldsmiths, who earned a fee from their secure storage businesses. Now, when a customer deposited their gold for safekeeping, the goldsmiths would issue IOU paper receipts, which were redeemable for gold at any time. Seeing that these paper receipts were backed 100% by gold, as well as the problems of trading precious metals directly, it didn't take too long for people to start trading the paper IOUs as if it were gold itself. Now, the goldsmiths had another business, that of lending their own gold at interest. Once their customers began trading in paper money, they noticed something else. Customers rarely came in to reclaim their gold, and never simultaneously. So the goldsmiths, now more bankers than artisans, decided to launch a plot whereby they would issue more paper receipts than they had actual gold on deposit in the vault. This scam worked perfectly, just as long as there was public confidence in the perceived value of those paper receipts. This is the philosophical basis for fractional reserve lending. These first bankers were saved just as long as all of their customers never lost faith in the currency by asking to reclaim their gold simultaneously. Whenever they did, the bankers would go out of business. This is known as a run on the bank. Keep in mind that a fractional reserve lending were never practiced by keeping adherence to 100% reserves of valuable commodities. Bank runs would literally become impossible. Thus concluding this allegorical examination of fractional reserve lending's historical development, let us now shift focus onto the diabolical technique itself as it is currently practiced. When the federal government needs more money, they create and sell treasury bonds to the Federal Reserve Bank, who in turn creates Federal Reserve Notes, FRNs, that are then exchanged for the bonds. Once the federales deposit the brand new FRNs in their own bank accounts, they become legal tender, and thus officially part of the national money supply. Now also keep in mind that these transactions are completely digital. Only 3% of the total American money supply is in some form of physical money, such as cash. The remaining 97% of the supply are digital records of deposits on hand. Put another way, this would mean the rest of M1, and by extension, M2 and M3. You must remember that government bonds are, by definition, instruments of debt. These exchanges are actually loans given to the federales by the Federal Reserve. This means that the entire money supply is based on debt instead of on value. Now, 10% of the deposit, pursuant to reserve requirements under statute, must be held as a required reserve. What this means is that the remaining 90% is considered an excessive reserve, and thus can be used as the basis for brand new loans. Now, this very same 90% is not created out of the original amount, but in addition to it. Mystically, the new deposits immediately become part of the bank's reserves of previously existing debt money. Since there are demands for loans as well as required reserves on deposit, new money is created irrespective of the growth of goods and services in the actual market. The Federal Reserve refers to this as deposit expansion. This is fractional reserve lending at its core. Now, the same process can be repeated many times over, with each cycle removing 10% of each new loan amount as a required reserve, with the resulting amount, the so-called excessive reserve, serving as the basis for yet another brand new loan in addition to the loan that it just came from. Now, because of this, $90 billion can be created in addition to the original $10 billion that was created by the Federales and the Fed when they swapped the bonds for FRNs. What this means is that 9 times any deposit amount can be created from less than nothing, that is, from debt. The value is provided from the already existing money supply. Each time there is a deposit expansion, there is a de facto inflation that reduces purchasing power, thereby stealing the real wealth of the world from the domestic population that produced it in the first place. Now, an inverse relationship exists between the purchasing power of the currency and the amount of it in circulation via the money supply. So $1 in 1913, when the Fed was established, was reduced to being worth $21.60 in 2007 in order to match value. This is a 96% devaluation in 94 years. Also notice the complementary relationship enjoyed between the money supply and the national debt. This exists because the currency itself is based on debt. Since the entire money supply is created out of loans, if all debts were paid, then there would be no money. Of course, that is impossible to achieve for the very simple reason that when the loans are being paid back, they must be done so with the principal plus the accrued interest, the latter of which does not exist in the money supply at all. This is the basis for a condition of perpetual debt that is guaranteed by the banking practice of fractional reserve lending. Now, there was an enlightening 1968 Minnesota court case of First National Bank of Montgomery versus Jerome Daly. Now, before being overturned on an appeal, the initial ruling of this case, as determined by the jury, found that there was no consideration, that is, real property, being exchanged. The issuance of FRNs via fractional reserve lending was blatantly fraudulent. Unfortunately, this case cannot be used as legal precedent. We are still forced to accept their currency in payment of genuine debt, pursuant to legal tender statutes. This is the basis for the inherent injustice of fractional reserve lending as it is practiced today, since it is mass counterfeiting protected by government privilege. It is corporatism at its finest, considering the literal monopoly the bankers retain over the issuance of currency and credit. Now, bank runs, perpetually accelerating debt, impossible to pay interest, and the debasement of the currency are all the inevitable effects of fractional reserve lending. Only the ridiculously stupid or insanely evil would ever allow this. Fractional reserve lending inherently requires government privilege and protection, for without it, those who are willing to compete in the free market would eventually beat whomever was practicing it, because the customers would eventually notice how the currency of the fractionally reserved banks stole their wealth, whereas the various other privately issued currencies do not, since they never loan out more than what they have in valuable tangibles. This is also known as possessing 100% reserves. And even these are not loaned at interest, but instead are issued in the same manner as a redeemable claim check. Now, once fractional reserve lending enjoys government privilege, then the entire banking industry is effectively oligopolized, since a central bank is needed to orchestrate the fraud, thereby firmly entrenching corporatism, which distorts the economy in every single other industry, whether cartelized itself or still relatively free to competition within the remnants of the actual market. Now, governments choose to legalize this form of mass counterfeiting because it provides cover for them to use the oligopolized banks to scapegoats, besides the fact that unmitigated borrowing and inflation are less offensive to the sensibilities of the hapless citizenry than taxes, whose effects are easily observable. The only reason that government continues to tax, above and beyond benefiting from fractionally reserved currency that is protected by fiat, is to further burden the population with draconian social engineering schemes, typically on behalf of other despotic special interests. In other words, both high finance special interests and the governments that shelter them both benefit enormously from this legalized scam that is literally forced onto the domestic population from the primary institution of a central bank. The government benefits from having cover for its other criminal activities, and the bankers benefit by stealing wealth while not being at risk for punishment by the state. Austerity masks the embezzlement of the international bankers everywhere. Now, given that a bank can only facilitate a loan between two other parties, where one is a producer and the other is a borrower who intends to extinguish the debt in the future, the borrower backs the value of the money only if he is convinced by the facilitator of the loan, in this case the bank, that he indeed owes the debt in the first place. If the developing countries of the world would simply not contract with the duplicitous World Bank, they would never be at risk for failing to repay their loans and thus suffer from the imposed conditionalities, thereby rendering them into serfs at the altar of parasitical imperialism. Thus, cyclical, constant chaos is needed in order to maintain the grand illusion, pursuant to the Hegelian dialectic. This is nothing less than economic warfare. Inevitable retaliatory actions by the state must be taken into account for security purposes. Governments are more than happy to crack down on those individuals and organizations who are attempting, strictly through the free market, to issue private alternative currencies. The main claim that the judiciary uses for these crackdowns is that the private issuers were counterfeiting the legal tender. This is sadly ironic and hypocritical, but not at all too surprising in another sense, because these very same government agents, as well as the mainline public in general, have literally no idea how the fractionally reserved fiat currency is brought into existence in the first place. Now, it could be said that auditing the central bank is a necessary precursor towards abolishment of it. This is not necessary, especially considering all the reliable, publicly available information that testifies to their rampant crimes. The issue really centers on repealing legal tender statutes, for if the FRNs had to actually compete with other currencies, they would easily lose, which is why they need government protection in the first place. If this goal eventually proves itself to not be effective, the only other way to get around it is to establish private alternative currencies. but they must prove themselves viable contenders amongst those who oppose central banking on principle. Lacking this, there is no real hope for victory against the establishment. And again, that was my article on fractional reserve lending. And now I'm going to try and give a brief postscript. You know, it's interesting. A lot of guys like to focus on, in order to deal with the Federal Reserve, the central bank, and the what passes itself off as the American dollar. A lot of guys have tried a lot of different things, but right now a lot of focus is with abolishing the Federal Reserve. But then a lot of people didn't want to do that, because why should we? So then Ron Paul, messiah that he is, or was, considering the scandal with his 2012 campaign, courtesy of Jesse Betton and other duplicitous asswipes, and as well as the insider testimony provided by Penny Freeman with her, when she did that interview with Adam Kokesh. You know, there's all this hubbub about auditing the Federal Reserve. And really? Because there have also been some other people that have said that the Federal Reserve has actually been audited several times. And then other people chime in about, oh, well, no, it's not been audited. Truly an audit. It's been kind of somewhat audited, but then not really audited, and then whatever. And then they just scream out all the details. Well, the only reason to audit the central bank is to convince, was to encourage and convince the fence-sitting Congress critters to then vote, to then later vote to abolish the central bank. I mean, that's the only reason at the end of the day. But then, of course, it kind of begs the question, are these, 400 some odd Congress critters actually going to limit their own power? Are they going to basically stop, all this tyranny that's going on? I mean, these are the same guys that passed the latest version of the NDAA and the, the various, take away our citizenship laws, the murder laws, and so on and so forth. So, they're kind of psychotically hell-bent. So are they going to do something that would essentially undermine their entire operation, which is the central bank practicing fractional reserve lending, and various other things, but the basis of it is that type of lending? No, of course not. It's kind of like telling Caesar Augustus or these other guys in history, hey, would you mind, laying, dismissing your army and then doing good things for the people? It's like, no, of course not. It's that would be antithetical. I mean, it's kind of like telling a tyrant, can you please do your proper job of ruling and not be a tyrant anymore? No, if they're dedicated, they're focused, and they're willing to see it through to the end, and they're committed, then asking them to flip 180 degrees without a real reason to do so, without some sort of miracle happening, personality change, brain surgery, if you will, is simply farcical. There's no other real way to describe it, and same thing here. Why should they audit the Fed? And more importantly, why should they end it? Why should they abolish it? It's great for them. It's a great scam. Helps them fund both the warfare state and the welfare state. And everything else, the police state too. So no, it doesn't make any sense, and Campaign for Liberty will fail in even just getting the Fed audited, or their version of the audit, excuse me. So all this whining and bickering about auditing the Fed is really not important, because it all ultimately depends on abolishing the Fed, and the Fed's not going to get abolished, at least not until the empire starts come crashing down. So all that would pretty much be happening at the same time. But the point is that it's the Congress, as part of the problem, is not going to solve another part of the problem, which is the Federal Reserve. Okay? That's the short version. So then that leads about what else can be done. Well, there's the alternative currencies thing, but then I, in the article I described kind of the problems with that. And basically what I was alluding to was probably the best case of this is what happened to Von Nuthaus, the issuer of the Liberty Dollar. Now, fortunately, there are other alternative currencies that haven't been cracked down on yet. Last time I checked, Ithaca Hours, The Plenty, Detroit Cheers, and a slew of others are still operating, and people still accept them. Their subscriber lists, their users have actually increased and whatnot. Bitcoin, particularly, as a unique kind of standalone one, albeit it's not local, but it is an alternative currency, a privately currency. Bitcoin especially has been developing by leaps and bounds, and obviously I'll go into alternative currencies at another time, but suffice it to say, I mean, that's what we're dealing with here. The survivalists have also suggested practicing how to barter in your local areas, and or agreeing on your own form of money, which is basically just an alternative currency. But they basically suggest doing both. Also using gold and silver bullion, or the actual coins with the metal, as a form of money in your own local areas too. So it's not a currency per se, but it's not actually an alternative currency, but it is a form of indirect barter when you're using gold and silver coins to trade. And then, of course, there's a whole bunch of side benefits that, of course, the government wouldn't like, such as the fact that they can't tax it. And so this kind of brings up also notions of the underground, or what Samuel Edward Konkin III called the counter-economy, which is a subject that I will be getting into in the future. But suffice it to say, this is how I just described how the scam works. Again, it's legalized mass counterfeiting. That's all it is. And the only reason why you have to care, especially if you're one of the new guys, is because you, me, and the guy down the street, all of us, are forced to accept it in payment of debt. Because if we refuse, there's all sorts of ranges of punishments, and I guess I could go into that at a later time, what specifically those are. But there's all sorts of punishments ranging from you don't get paid, so the government considers the debt discharged even though you weren't actually, you didn't receive any sort of consideration or payment, to them locking you up for a little bit. I mean, so there's a range. So that's pretty much what we're dealing with. That's why the FRNs are crappy. That's also another reason why we have these boom-bust cycles. You don't have to subscribe to the Austrian theory of the business cycle, but I'm saying that generally speaking, why you have boom-bust cycles in general, because that's not normal economic behavior in any real free market. That's because you have a... Look, in the Communist Manifesto, they said you have to have a central bank, okay? This is what happens when you have a central bank. They basically socialize the economy. Even if it's not full-blown socialism or even communism, it's interesting. The American economy has been described as a mixed economy. Well, part of the mix is the socialistic aspects of it, with the manipulation of the currency. So even if you're not dealing with an oligopolized industry like big oil, big food, big pharma, big fuck whatever, even when you're dealing within the remnants of the free market where there's actually competition going on, a lot of those guys still have to use FRNs if they're still operating under a white market or legal conditions. So without getting into black or gray markets, if you're dealing just strictly in the white market kind of companies and businesses, they all have to use FRNs because of legal tender statutes. That's where the coercion of government comes in. So hopefully that actually explains the problem to you, so you don't have to waste any more time, you know, watching all these documentaries and reading all these people's books like I've had to do, the various monetary reform theorists, both from the Goldbug and Greenbacker camps. Hopefully you don't have to really do that anymore or really get into it at all, unless you're specifically focusing on... in a tutorial type sense, on learning how to indirectly barter with gold and silver, how to establish and run your own private currency, whether a local one that's like a paper money kind, that's preferably backed by something, or using Bitcoin, which is kind of its own separate kit and caboodle. But really, that's what I kind of hope this is coming to, is that you stop whining and bitching about, you know, foreclosure gate and the subprime mortgage crisis, because you have no power over that. Neither do I. But what we do have power over is indirectly bartering with our neighbors and various contacts, of establishing and running local alternative currencies, of running alternative currencies that aren't local, such as Bitcoin, and whatever else anybody else comes up with that actually could work. That's it. So stop fucking obsessing over the Federal Reserve. Yes, they're bad, but there never will be anything considered a commonly acceptable audit by any political dissidents, because somebody will always whine and bitch that it's not a real audit. Somebody will. And even if all the gold bugs get together and said it's a real audit, some greenback will whine and gnash, grind and gnash their teeth over it. And more importantly, the Federal Reserve will not be abolished by the Congress. Unless a miracle happens, which again, you and I have no control over, only the Congress can do it, then why obsess over it? Why? I mean, yeah, I guess you could say it's this, you know, seven, you know, the den of vipers. It's the seven-headed hydra. It's the Jekyll Island creature. It's the debt, you know, it's the source of the debt spider, all these metaphors. But at the end of the day, it's a central bank that enjoys government privilege, that coercively accepts the population to accept their scammy Ponzi scheme-esque type money or currency. Because it's not really money. It's because they call it... I mean, I know a lot of the monetary reform theorists call it debt money, but that's not... It's used for shorthand, but it's not really money. It's just a fractional reserve, fiat, receipt, funny money. That's all it is. So anything you can do to get off of it, to reduce your use of it as much as possible, and preferably staying out of jail doing it, because I think it's would behoove all of us to keep as many of our people out of jail as possible, because you cannot be a freedom fighter from prison, then we can actually start getting somewhere. So hopefully that's been impressed upon you. So for next episode, we're going to change gears a bit and get away from looking at the different aspects of the establishment and why we're opposing and you know, why it's a bad thing that we don't want to support, basically. So we're going to change gears a bit, and we're going to delve into dissident philosophy. That is why good people are opposed to the establishment. And we're going to begin with looking at, with next episode, we're going to begin with looking at the victim mentality. I'm Sleepy Salsa, and thanks for listening.